I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. If you've been paying attention to the presidential primary, you've seen candidates' poll numbers go up and down. For a while, Ben Carson was leading the Republican pack, and now his numbers have fallen. Donald Trump brags about his poll numbers at every campaign stop, and they're huge. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders' poll numbers have fluctuated over the last months, and we're still several months away from the first vote. That would be the Iowa caucuses on February 1st. Today on the show, we want to examine the methodology, the accuracy, and impact of polling, and why it's getting tougher for pollsters to do their jobs. Later in the show, we'll talk with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of Gallup, who'll be telling us why they're getting out of horse race polling. Joining us now is Cliff Zukin. He's public opinion researcher, professor of public policy and political science at the Edward J. Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University. He previously served as the president of the American Association of Public Opinion Research. And Cliff Zukin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Do we have our guest? Cliff.
Marty.
Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me back. I appreciate being with you.
Absolutely. Let me introduce our other guest. David Anderson is assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University. He's done polling in Iowa. And David Anderson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Cliff, let me begin with you and begin with something that you wrote recently. You said polling is in a near crisis. What's the problem?
Well, I said election polling is in a near crisis, and I don't want to make that distinction. With election polling, it's just become very much harder to do just in the last 8 years for two or three reasons. One is a tremendous growth of cell phones that make it much more expensive for us to actually do a good survey. Second is a declining response rate, which means thousands of more calls and maybe a question of representativeness. And then third, with turnout going down in the United States, it's increasingly difficult to find who real likely voters are. And you put those problems together and polling becomes much more expensive and hard to do and so more unreliable.
And why more expensive? Why does that increase the cost of polling?
That's a very good question. It is far more expensive for us to call cell phones than it is to call landlines. Most people don't know that. The Telephone Consumer Protection Act prohibits us using automatic dialers to dial cell phones, and so they have to be dialed by hand. And when we were doing the election as recently as 8 years ago or 10 years ago, cell phones were 6% of the American public. Right now, in the as of the first part of 2015. Cell phones are now actually 63%, if you believe that. The combination of 47% of the public is cell phone only, and another 16% is cell phone mainly. So you have to include cell phones in. They have to be dialed manually. And if you're dialing those manually and your response rate's very low, you might have to dial 40,000 numbers to get a sample of 1,000. And so it's become much more expensive in just the last 8 years.
And dialing manually means hiring people to do the dialing, right?
Yes. You have to have interviewers who sit there for a whole shift and dial 10 numbers and with a 10% response rate and cell phones going to businesses and so forth, they might not get an interview the whole shift. And so it's become extraordinarily expensive to do well, and that's been driving polling to the internet, where we really have not figured out how to do that well at all yet.
David, let me get you in on the conversation. You've done some polling in Iowa. Is Iowa uniquely challenging place to do polling?
I don't think it's uniquely challenging. I think Cliff is totally correct in that everywhere in America is just a challenge to poll right now, if you're talking about elections. Just figuring out who you should be talking to and then trying to actually get them to answer the phone and just talk to you for 5 minutes is exceedingly difficult these days.
Well, I have to say, when I get those phone calls, I don't answer them because I'm a journalist. But on the other hand, I don't answer them because I don't want to. How much is that a problem, David?
It's a huge problem. And in that regard, polling in Iowa may have somewhat of a unique challenge right now, because people in Iowa right now are getting surveyed all the time.
Yeah.
The rest of the nation kind of gets a break, but in New Hampshire and Iowa, because of the first states, there's lots of polls going out. And when your phone rings here, you kind of cringe if you don't recognize the number. You can pretty well assume it's a pollster asking you your opinion.
Well, let me toss that back to you, Cliff. And as you said, the response rate has dropped precipitously. And is it because people are busy? They're suspicious about polls. They can monitor who's calling in. They can let it go to voicemail, things like that?
I think so. And then, again, the change to cell phones and even digital services at home, you can now see the caller. So if before, 10 years ago, the phone rang and your presumption was just to pick it up, now you can actually know if it's someone you know or not and make a decision that unless it's someone I know, I'm not going to pick it up, especially with cells where it actually costs you minutes to do that. So I think there's a great deal more screening going on. And then also, you know, people are very upset and tired with market research phone calls that, you know, call at certain hours of the day and inundate them. And so that's why what's one of the things that's interesting to me is the percentage of those people who really have both cell phones and landlines who just now only do incoming calls on their cell phones. They don't even take incoming calls on landlines now. And that's been growing, too. That's now about one-fifth of the citizenry.
Let me pick up on something else. Cliff, you mentioned, and David, I'll toss it to you, which is this question about likely voters and looking at things like turnout. Turnout has, I guess, been falling over the last couple of decades. And people, I guess, who identify themselves as going to vote for one candidate or another. And the question is, will they actually go to the polls and vote? David?
That is a great question that we really have no idea about right now. If you look at the last 8 years, we're talking about presidential elections, the story is largely that Obama was able to bring a new group of people to the polls. But now Obama won't be on the ballot. So we don't know if those people are going to come back and vote. And now on the other side, you have Donald Trump, whose supporters are largely people who have not voted and participated before. So we have no idea who's going to show up on Election Day.
And that really hurts us in this third area of trying to determine who likely voters are. All pollsters have a problem that people overreport their vote intentions because it's part of the norm of being a good citizen and people think they should vote. So we may have an election where turnout is historically 50% and 70% will tell us they're going to vote. And so we have the issue then of trying to figure out which of those people are more likely than others. And then we have the problem, as David alluded to, of figuring out how many people will actually vote in the election. One of the problems of the polls in 2014, one of the problems of their performance, was that no one modeled a likely electorate of 39%. Mm. Turnout was the lowest since World War II, and none of the pollsters had that in their model. When Frank Newport joins you or us shortly, they did a terrific paper at the 2014 APOR conference where they presented the results of maybe eight or nine different pollsters trying to figure out who was going to win 2014. And all of them had too high a turnout number. And many believe that that's the reason that polls did not predict a Republican victory in 2014 to the extent it did. They were looking at higher turnouts with more Democrats in them.
David, let me go back to you. And as you said, it looks like a lot of Donald Trump's supporters are people who haven't voted before. In terms of predicting likely voters, are people more likely to vote if they have voted before?
Yes, absolutely. Voting, like most things, you can best predict if you know people's prior behavior. So the leading indicator for all of us for voting in the next election is whether we voted in the last election. Which normally works just fine, but when you have a candidate who really energizes a new segment of America, people who typically don't vote or don't participate, like it looks like Donald Trump is doing, it gives pollsters a real headache in trying to estimate who's going to show up and actually vote for him.
So,
and, you know, that
yeah, go ahead, Cliff.
I was going to say that headache is bigger in Iowa and New Hampshire and primary states. Even though New Hampshire is one of the strongest turnout states we have, turnout in there is 40%. If you go back in Iowa, the last two or three contested caucuses, turnout's only about 20%. It's still finding the needle in the haystack when you call people up at random and ask them if they're going to turn out. And one of the things we know about Iowa caucus voters is that they are heavily conservative, and they are heavily evangelical. And we've seen that from the exit polls at the last Iowa caucuses. And so probably polls that don't take that into account will overstate Donald Trump's support and maybe understate evangelical religious candidates. But again, we have to remember that turnout in primaries and caucuses is extremely small, and that makes finding likely voters extremely difficult.
Well, David, when people go to caucuses in Iowa, this is February 1st, so it's going to be really cold, I assume. You have to go to somebody's house, right? You're going to spend more than 5 minutes just punching into a screen to pick your candidates. It really requires a very dedicated voter, a caucus goer.
Absolutely. You have to be willing to not just give up 5 minutes of your time to drive to a poll. You have to be willing to give up to 3 hours of your time after you've done a full day of work. You probably have family at home ready to sit down for dinner. This is not just an easy task to undertake. Kind of going on the idea of how difficult it is to predict turnout, we have such low voter turnout in the caucuses, about 20%, as Cliff said, that just a small shift in how many people show up can have huge repercussions on the overall result. I think in the 2012 Republican caucuses, we had about 125,000 people. So if you have a shift of 5,000 or 10,000 people, that's a massive change in who's there voting, and it can determine who wins and who loses.
And just to remind us, who won in 2012 Republican side and the Democratic side?
In the Democratic side, it wasn't competitive because Barack Obama was the only one.
Right.
On the Republican side, it was controversial because the day after the caucuses, the GOP announced that Mitt Romney won, and then they recounted the ballots, and it turned out that Santorum had won by a few votes. And it was very unclear, and it was kind of disputed afterwards that the big advantage to winning the Iowa caucuses is usually you get momentum. And Mitt Romney left Iowa with the momentum. Then we found out that Rick Santorum probably should have had that momentum, and it didn't give either candidate the benefit I think they wanted or felt they deserved.
So, Cliff, and we're almost up in a break here, and then we have Frank Newport, who's going to be joining us after the break. But, you look and you hear and you read about the enthusiastic crowds for some of these candidates. Does that have any impact on polling?
I don't really think it does. I think that most of the people who vote in polls are already extremely engaged and interested, and I don't think they're really swayed by those sorts of campaign activities. I think they're more committed to a candidate and a personal, but I think they're largely inert from rallies and things like that. Otherwise, I think we'd see Chris Christie, who's drawing, well in New Hampshire and so forth and other places at these rallies and town halls, doing better in the polls. There does seem to be a disconnect between the two.
Well, we are deconstructing polls with our guests, Cliff Zukin from Rutgers University, David Anderson from Iowa State University, and we'll be joined by our third guest after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are deconstructing the methodology, the accuracy, the influence, and the predictive ability of polls, why it's harder to do good ones. And our guests are Cliff Zukin. He's a public opinion researcher, also a professor at Rutgers University. David Anderson with us as well, assistant professor at Iowa State University, who has done caucus polling. And joining us now is Frank Newport, and he'll be telling us why Gallup is getting out of the horse race polling, at least for the primary. He's editor-in-chief at Gallup. And Frank, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. So why are you getting out of this so-called horse race polling?
Well, my first point would be that it does not our decisions on emphasis is what I would say. It's just a question of what we think is the best thing to emphasize as we expend our resources in polling. Does not reflect anything about the methods of polling, which I have a great deal of faith in. I think polling continues to do a good job of representing the underlying national population. When we do our methods right, we certainly face changes, but polling has faced changes all the way back to the 1930s in how it does its job. and what the method should be and how we have to change things to reflect ways of communicating and sampling and understanding the American population. So it's not a reflection. Anything we do here is not a reflection on our underlying competence in polling in general, but it's more a reflection on what we at Gallup think we can contribute the most. There are a wide variety of issues and concerns on the part of the American public, and I personally believe that having those issues represented in the dialogue, having accurate understanding of what Americans want their elected officials to do, particularly in a time where Americans have less and less confidence in their elected leaders, is a very important job. And if we spend more time doing that and with our, you know, finite amount of resources, focus less on a lot of time on the so-called horse race polling, figuring out who's going to vote, I think we at Gallup, at any rate, can make a more substantial contribution.
So you're saying the sort of who's up and who's down, and it seems almost every day there are new polls who are giving this information.
That's right.
Are you saying, Frank, it's just too crowded a field, and in the end, if a poll is a snapshot, it doesn't have much predictive ability?
Well, it's certainly a crowded field, but there's always been a lot of horse race polling, and I think horse race polling can be valuable. For one thing, we know people are extraordinarily interested in it. So clearly, if an organization wants to attract attention from its polling, it does horse race polling, because at least momentarily it's going to get the flash of great interest in, across people who are covering news and following the election. But I don't think our decision has to do necessarily with the fact that it's a crowded field. It simply is a question of where we can best use our resources to help, not to sound too pious about it, but to help move the democracy forward, help us do a better job of getting good elected officials and, all more importantly, having our elected officials respond to the people once they're in office.
Frank, you've used the word money or resources several times in the last couple of minutes. How much of that is an issue for an organization like Gallup?
Well, I'm simply saying that any organization has to decide where it wants to do its polling. It's hard to do all things to all people. And if you spend time focusing on the horse race, that is a significant effort. You not only have to ask people who they're going to vote for, but you have to spend a lot of time asking a wide variety of questions about propensity to voting, past history of voting, and so forth, at least the way we do it. And that all takes a lot of time to do and a lot of effort. And the question is, if you spent that same amount of time and effort focusing on understanding some other things, are you going to make an equal or greater contribution? And we at Gallup, for our own personal goals organizationally, think we probably can.
Well, and Gallup, is that you, David?
No, it's Cliff.
That's Cliff. Go ahead, Cliff.
I was going to say, Gallup is not the only major polling organization who's come to this conclusion. The Pew Research Center, and that's led by Michael Dimmock, its president, has also decided to do less in the way of horse race polling, and largely for the same reasons. What Frank said about, and you, Marty, noted he used resources two or three times.
Yes.
You know, my argument is that to do it well, and places like Gallup and Pew are going to do it well if they do it, it takes a lot more resources to do it well now because of the cell phones and the things Frank's were talking about. And I agree with them that, you know, the horse race is probably the least important thing or responsibility of polling in a democracy of democratic discussion. But I do miss the Gallups and the Pews being out there just to make sure, because they would do it well, and I'm not sure other organizations are doing it as well.
Well, let me put this question to all three of you, and Frank, I'll start with you. I mean, do you think that the press, which relies so much on polling these days, do you think the press overstates, misuses polling information, makes it more important than it actually is? And I guess in many ways we are talking about the kind of horse race polling, who's up, who's down. Frank?
Well, I think it's great if the press pays attention to polling, particularly public opinion, on what the people are thinking and feeling. And if they do it well, this is a total subject for another of your shows, Marty,
yes,
about how effectively the media and the press and everyone else can cover anything in today's environment with so many disparate voices and such a low barrier to entry for somebody sitting in their basement to tap out internet comments and so forth. But I think in general, It's great if we have more coverage of public opinion and get the public injected into the dialogue in a way that that can be done reliably and is important. Now, the coverage of the horse race is a natural instinct on the part of people, and I think somebody called me up from Europe and so forth and said, "Oh, should we ban horse race polling?" Not at all. I think that's fine to have that in the discussion because it's a human tendency, probably human nature, to want to know who's ahead and who's not at this point, and I think that could be useful information. But if I had my druthers, I certainly would, and we're trying to push that way at Gallup, would suggest that all of those that we call, quote, the media, in quotes, spend some more time talking about public opinion and public desires and what public wants their elected officials to do rather than simply at the moment who they would vote for.
What do you think, David?
I largely agree with that. I think the media kind of writes the best stories they can with what they have, and what they have to talk about the campaigns right now is largely polling. Everybody wants to know who's going to win or who's leading right now, and the only good indication we have is really polling. We could look at fundraising or maybe how many people attend a rally, but really, polls are the best way to know who's supporting the candidates, how well the candidates are doing compared to each other, and that's valuable information. I think maybe the debate could be more sophisticated. I have some reservations about using national polling right now because I think people outside of Iowa and New Hampshire haven't met the candidates yet. They haven't heard from the candidates. They don't really know much about the candidates other than polling results. The people in Iowa and New Hampshire, I think, are a little bit more educated right now. And I think the value of polling, especially in these states, is it gives a signal to the rest of the nation that, you know, right now in Iowa, Ted Cruz is surging. Maybe you should take 5 minutes and look at who Ted Cruz is and what he stands for. I absolutely think there's value in this. But I also agree with Frank that it would kind of be nice if we could spend more attention on, outside of the candidates, what is it that Americans really want? Forget about whether Trump is putting a policy forward or Cruz or Hillary. What do the people want to hear? I think there's real value in that, and it's not done enough.
What do you think, Cliff?
Well, I don't think polling has disserved this race at all so far. I think people have becoming more aware of the Republican candidates. I think the real changes that you've seen in support for Trump and Ben Carson and Fiorina, who have gone up after good performances and down when they are controversial or don't perform well. You know, I think that's a reasonable way of, I mean, I'm pretty happy with it in that it suggests some public learning through the process. I do sort of disagree with David in that Iowa and New Hampshire are both so unrepresentative. Iowa being very, very conservative and New Hampshire also being way out of the mainstream, that I think there's a disservice in having too much attention on these early tests.
Because they don't look like the other states in this country?
Because they don't. And we know that there are bad dynamics that come out of winning these early tests. So what happens if you win a state that has a very, very evangelical and fundamentalist bounce that's out of step with the most of the country, and that candidate gets a good bounce from that? You know, is that helpful or is that a distortion? I would much rather see four or five early tests at the same time that are diverse rather than the Iowa and New Hampshire. So I think there's some problems with the primary process itself that can lead to distortions. I mean, what the nomination process is the first step of the country selecting leadership. And so you'd rather not see distortions either by the structure of the primaries or by polls misbehaving, or by other things. But I think so far some citizen learning has been going on from the debates, and so I don't think it's been a bad process so far.
Frank, final question to you, and this goes back to the 2012 election when Gallup's, I guess it was your final pre-election poll, you predicted that Mitt Romney was going to get 49% and President Obama getting 48%. It didn't work out that way, obviously. But was that a lesson or some kind of a wake-up call for Gallup?
Well, I wouldn't say a wake-up call, certainly. All of the polls in 2012 skewed towards most all of them, but if you put them on a distribution skewed towards a smaller margin of victory for Obama than he finally ended up getting. But polling can, in an election, in a trial heat, can be useful to calibrate to some degree what you're doing. The problem is that your underlying polling methodology is only part of the issue when you are, in turn, trying to predict the outcome of an election. A lot of it, and I think your other two guests have talked about it, has been trying to isolate likely voters,
right,
which really doesn't reflect on the underlying methodology. But at any rate, we, after 2012, took the advantage of that situation to do an exhaustive review of a lot of what you know, what we did in the election and underlying methodology, as well as likely voter methods and so forth and so on. And we tweaked some things that we thought were important to tweak. So certainly we use any opportunity we can to keep improving what we're doing overall. And that was an opportunity to do that.
Well, Frank Newport, thank you so much for joining us today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Organization. And we are talking about polling in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. You can join the conversation 1-888-477-9499. A bunch of comments here, radiotimes at whyy.org. And you can tweet us at whyy Radio Times. Let me just read an email from Peter. This came up earlier this week where Trump said that most Americans are anti-United States and he wanted to keep them out of the country. This apparently is based on a poll that turns out to be an internet poll taken by someone described as someone an anti-Muslim organization. I'm just quoting here. Could your pollsters comment on this? And Cliff, I mean, there are polls that are done responsibly and scientifically, and then there are ones that aren't. And I think for the public, how do you differentiate between the two?
Well, the first thing we would differentiate or use to differentiate is the sample. There are two different, we do what we call probability samples. And there are internet polls and opt-in polls that do non-probability samples. And with a non-probability sample, you can't generalize back from that sample to the population. The mathematics don't work. The laws of mathematics that we use to make samples representative so far do not apply to internet polls. And so if it's an internet poll that doesn't have a valid sample, then I think you dismiss the poll.
But I guess for the public, you know, it's hard to know what you're dealing with.
It is, and that's the problem. And I understand, and you can't expect the public to do that. I think we need to have journalists be doing a better job as gatekeepers, and I think that's hard for journalists too. But as you suggest, there's just a lot of crap out there now. There's a lot of legitimate polls, but there's a lot.
I didn't use that word, but that's okay. I hear you.
It was a minor word for crap.
It is. I hear you.
But there's some really poorly done polls, and most internet polls, what most people should know, is that most internet polls are not probability samples. We haven't figured out a way to do a good internet poll yet, and yet the whole industry is moving there. We are not there by 2016. And so most internet polls are unreliable, and the problem is internet polls are so cheap that anybody can do one.
Interesting.
But the question is, who is the sample? Is it representative? And right now most internet polls are non-probability samples and don't have that base in probability theory and mathematics that traditional polls do.
Well, you're listening to Ballot Talks on Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me read a tweet for you, and this goes to you, David. I went to four caucuses when living in Iowa. At three of them, we were surprised by both the turnout, the level of support, plus and minus of the candidate. So clearly someone went to the caucuses and seems like they had a pretty good experience.
Sure. I think the general norm is that people enjoy caucuses a lot more than they enjoy voting. When you go to the caucus, it's a social experience. You don't just walk in the door and get asked your opinion and then get told to leave. It's an interactive experience where you talk to other people, you ask them why they're going to support the candidate they're supporting, you kind of assemble into your groups. And then in the next round, people actively try to persuade you and change your mind. It's fun. The caucuses are not just a static event. They're something that I think the people who go to get a lot out of.
We also have a tweet wanting to know what data is stored about you when polling is done. And I think to you, Cliff, that taps into a sense of, if not paranoia, then suspicion about talking to anonymous people who are asking personal questions or political questions.
A good polling organization will store nothing about you. And your name will not be associated, or address will not be associated with your answers. It'll be a separate data file that they might need to link to call you back or something. But your name, by all good data standards and by the ethics of the profession, is kept separate. Now, there are, of course, partisan pollsters and people who build voter files who do store that information. But from a neutral public opinion researcher, that's not something that is going to happen.
David, a tweet from Dana who says, do polls cause voters not to get out and vote because so-and-so is going to win anyway? Does it depress the vote, do you think, for certain candidates?
It's possible. There's a lot we really don't know about the effect of polls. When you see that your candidate is way, way ahead in the polls just a day before the election, it does reduce your motivation to go out and vote. We really don't have any idea whether this has determined the fate of elections, but there is kind of a popular thought that the best thing for turnout are very close polls, because that motivates everybody to get out and cast their vote because their vote might matter.
I think that's a drop in the ocean. I really do. I think those people who know the competitive standings of the candidates are the best informed and the most motivated, and I don't think it changes what they do. And those people who are the least informed are least likely to vote and least likely to know what a poll says. I think we have a much bigger and more fundamental problem with the dropping level of turnout by age and civic norms and duties of citizenship, to the point where, again, our turnout in 2014 was the lowest it's been since World War II. And that's been a trend that's been continuing for the last 20 years. I think that's a much more fundamental and systematic problem than polling inhibiting turnout.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, pick up on several things that you just said. Talking with Cliff Zukin, David Anderson, about polls and polling. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with David Anderson. He's an assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University. He's done polling in Iowa. Also with us, Cliff Zukin. He's a public opinion researcher and professor of public policy and political science at the Edward J. Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University. And we are talking about polling, pollsters, people who don't like to answer polls, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We actually have a Facebook comment from Deborah. She says, my favorite poll question is one that goes something like this. Are you satisfied with the direction the country is heading? In these times, Deborah says, both ends of the political spectrum could answer the same thing, which gets to a question about the kinds of questions, the wording used, how things are framed, probably the sequence of questions. Cliff, how important is that?
It's pretty important. It's a big topic that we've been studying for years and years and years, which is question wording and question formatting and question ordering. And we know that there's some reactivity, that the effects of early answers affect later answers, and whether how questions are wording can affect them. I would say that the rules are that when people know the least, question wording matters the most. So if we're talking about the Keystone Pipeline, then question wording matters a tremendous amount. If we're talking about the president's job performance rating, then it doesn't matter so much.
Well, David, I'm looking at a poll that you were part of at Iowa State University. I just randomly picked question 20. Which of the following factors is most important to you in your decision to support a candidate for president? Is it whether the candidate cares about people, is honest and trustworthy, takes strong stands, has the right experience, or can win the election, don't know, refused? These seem like sort of basic poll questions. But why, care about people, take strong stands? Why are these important?
These are things that we've identified that when you talk to voters, they say this is the kind of thing that leads them to support a candidate. And in coming up with the possible answers that people can give, we try to kind of fill the universe of possibilities. What possible things can we think of that would lead people to prefer one candidate over another? And one of the goals in running our poll was to figure out what is leading people to support the various candidates, just to give us an indication of what matters in this campaign.
I have a pet peeve, and this has to do with this margin of error. Perhaps my pet peeve is with the media, not with the two of you. But when you see candidates, especially at the Republican debates, and you see who had 3%, who had 4%, who had 6%, and then you look down and you see the margin of error might be 3, 4, 5, or 6%, Cliff, is there any difference between someone who has 5% of the vote and someone who has 7% of the vote?
Absolutely not. And that's misusing a tool to me. I mean, that's like asking a scale that can only do pounds to get into ounces. That all polls can really do, and this has been a troubling thing since so many of them were used as criteria for entering the Republican debates, all polls can really do at this point is talk about clumps of candidates. You know, we know that 23 is different from 12, but 23 and 27 and 22 and 21 are really all the same number. And so, no, polls cannot be used to make fine gradations at all and really shouldn't be used for that purpose.
I mean, the Republican Party has used that, David, as we all know, to create, you know, what's been called the sort of, you know, the main event and then the hors d'oeuvre event, depending on what candidates' polls numbers were. How much do you think that has hurt either polling or even how we think about some of these candidates?
Well, I don't think it's hurt polling, but I think it is a terrible misuse of polling data. To have a cutoff, I think one of the cutoffs was you have to have 1% of the poll result in a national poll, which is really just an arbitrary number. When you have a margin of error of 3 or 4%, to have 1% just doesn't mean much. And I think it keeps certain candidates off the stage, which is debatable in terms of is that okay or not? You have to have some threshold when you have 15 or 16 candidates. You have to have some threshold of the top-tier candidates who really have a shot and then the lower-tier candidates who really have not won over enough support to have earned a place on the main stage.
What it does is to take the pressure off journalists to make the decisions and news organizations to make the decisions. And they can say, okay, well, we have an objective standard. It's not just us. But as David knows, in reality, you might as well just flip a coin among all those people at the bottom, and you know, because it's effectively random. It has nothing to do with their strength in the electorate, because polls can't make that determination.
What's interesting to me, and I don't know the answer to it, but for a while, Ben Carson was really leading the polls, perhaps both nationally and also in some of these early states. He's taken a tumble. I think he's had some pretty serious stumbles. And I wonder to you, David, is there a kind of a cause and effect that if someone really muffs a bunch of important answers, that it does show up in the polls?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think this is part of the value of polls this far out from an actual election. We are certainly not predicting who's going to win an election right now. We're way too far out. But we do give an indication of when a candidate kind of surges in public opinion because people are paying attention to them. They find things they like about them. And that attention kind of brings, I think, the public of America to focus on them and listen to what they're saying. I think one of the things we learned about Ben Carson was that in Iowa, he was doing very well, in part because Iowa has a lot of social conservatives and a lot of evangelicals, and they really liked Ben Carson. And then the rest of the country kind of focused in and said, okay, he's surging in the polls, let's listen to him. And I think the consensus really is that they didn't like what he had to say.
I think that's right. One of my gripes in this, Marty, is that commentators will say the polls say. And, you know, if the polls are done well, what we're really saying is the public says.
Yes, I hear you.
Yeah, if we're measuring public opinion honestly, then we're saying the public has reacted to this. It's not that we're making things up and so that the polls have a voice independent of the thousand or so for people we interview.
Let me read another. This is sort of a theme I hear during the hour. This is a Facebook comment from Marilyn who says, the reason I don't answer my landline if I don't recognize the caller is that I'm trying to avoid calls from the political organizations or candidates who are asking me for money or asking me to volunteer. I'm still a committed liberal, but I don't want to talk to these folks. If I knew they were pollsters, I would pick up. And I guess, David, that's a challenge, which is, you know, how do you, I guess, either identify yourself so the people like Marilyn would say, oh, I will talk to David about his poll.
It would be wonderful if we had some national opt-in list where people could just say, I will only answer public opinion questions, put me in the pool of possible contacts. That would be great. Unfortunately, it just doesn't exist right now.
So it's just it's a kind of potluck, I guess. And if we're talking about landlines, Cliff, I'm assuming that skews probably older. Does it skew whiter than the electorate in general?
It absolutely does. And in fact, you know, right now in terms of cell phones, there are certain age groups of 30-year-olds, for example, that 70% of them are cell phone only. And the other side is that landlines are very, very old. In fact, I was looking at who voted in 2014 and seeing the bias of internet polls. And of those people who were on landlines only, they're much stronger voters than those people who were cell phone only because they're older.
And you were talking about 2014 as a kind of, I get what, a watershed year because the turnout was so low. Now, it was an off-year presidential election, but nonetheless, Cliff, it's always worrisome when you see such a low either interest in the issues, the candidates, or even the act of voting.
Absolutely. It's not that we lack for important issues. You know, we're still coming out of the worst recession since the Depression. We have tremendous problems with ISIS. We have a budget deficit. There's a lot of reasons people should be attentive. We now have college student loans now outnumber consumer loans. There's even good reasons for young people to be hyper-attentive. But we have gone through two generations now with Gen Xers and then .NETs who have not voted in the same frequency and with the same conviction as the people before them. And it's really a civic value that has fallen off the table, and a very dangerous one. One of the reasons I think that we have such a shrill set of politics now is that the middle is missing, and we're leaving those people to participate who feel very extremely at both ends, and that's not a healthy dialogue. The political system is where values are supposed to go to be accommodated and compromised, and decisions get made so you move on, and right now we're not being able to do this. The political system is frozen.
David, an email from Phyllis. She says, I'm always perturbed about the topics left out of opinion polls. Some issues that I care about are never included, such as labeling GMOs. And I guess the question is, you know, how do you decide on those questions? And does it really speak to the issues that the public says that they care about? Now, Phyllis cares about it. The question is, do other people care about it as well?
That is an extremely difficult question, figuring out what options to make available to people. I think another example of this is if you do a poll right now on the Republican candidates, right now you can have 15 candidates included, or you could choose to just say, here are the six most viable, and you'll get probably quite different results. With Phyllis's issue about GMOs, my guess is that that's not typically included because we don't have enough evidence that people are making vote decisions or decisions on who to support based upon that issue, and it's not widespread throughout the electorate. And these are the things we have to look at when we decide what options to include.
Well, I'm looking at your list here, economy in general, dissatisfaction with government, Congress, race relations, racism, immigration, illegal aliens, unemployment, jobs, morality, ethics, religious issues, family decline, dishonesty, federal budget deficit, federal deficit, and goes on, poverty, hunger, homelessness. These are the sort of questions about asking, David, what problems voters care about.
Yeah, these are big national issues that have
huge.
Kind of stood the test of time.
Cliff, you want to weigh in on that at all?
I'm sympathetic to her point about not asking about issues that she's interested in.
part of the problem, this goes back to what I was saying when question wording matters most, when people know least, is that there has to be a sufficient amount of discussion in the citizenry about issues before I think a lot of us feel comfortable polling on it. Because we don't want to create opinions with the questions we ask and the way we ask them. We really try to want to measure what's there. And so if it's a leading issue that is just beginning phases of public debate, that's, I think, where we have problems deciding when to poll and what to ask about.
Which might explain why there are questions about ISIS, for instance, Cliff.
Yeah, I mean, because everybody should have an opinion about that. Again, I don't know if everybody's going to have an opinion about all tactics to defeat them, but certainly in terms of willing to spend tax dollars, whether the U.S. should commit ground troops, whether we should be in it alone or have allies, those, I think, are reasonable questions to put to the public.
Well, we are talking about the public, and we're talking about polls and the press with Cliff Zukin, David Anderson, and you're listening to Ballot Talks here on Radio Times on WHYY. We haven't really talked about the kind of polling that the candidates do for themselves. And David, in our pre-interview, you talk about candidates living in a bubble. You know, they speak to adoring crowds. They have their people who tell them how great they are. How do you penetrate something like that?
As in what the candidates know about their own polling?
Yeah. I mean, how much sort of honest polling do they have about themselves?
Well, they have pretty good polling. What we don't know is how much they have and what they know. Candidates tend to not release their own poll numbers, so we don't know what they're seeing. But they do extensive polling on their own to figure out not only how they're doing in the horse race, but which of their messages is resonating with the population. And that's a very important of campaigning that really I don't think public polling focuses on as much. Because the candidates don't just want to know what public opinion is, they want to shift it. So they kind of do another level of polling to find out how much people enjoy hearing what they're talking about. And if they find out that the public doesn't care so much, they may shift their message because they really need to drive public opinion in their favor.
And I wonder, Cliff, you know, wonky people like us are paying attention to elections obsessively. But for most people, they really don't pay attention until sometimes several weeks before an election. How do we take them into account?
Well, that's when I think we see public opinion starting to shift, Marty. And it's not that necessarily people are changing their minds, but we reach a different level of attentiveness of the citizenry. In my world, I think of the public as being in tiers, where maybe 20% of the U.S. public is really attentive citizens. And then another 30% sort of get activated as the campaign heats up and there's prominence to events and sustained coverage. And then another 30% just sort of bounce around and get whatever information's there, and most of them will not vote. And then 20% are completely apathetic, that they don't even know there's an election going on. So right now, we're in the first ring, if you will,
right,
of about 20%, and that's who's driving things right now.
Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Cliff Zukin, thanks so much.
Thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
Us as well. And he's public opinion researcher, professor of public policy and political science at Rutgers University in New Jersey. David Anderson, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Fun for us, too. David Anderson, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University. And we also spoke with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup Organization. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.